where they come together and inform and entertain our listeners. We inform and entertain. That's the key. And it's community. And a major part of our community is indeed the arts and the artists who work in the fields. Perhaps one of the most significant entities, organizations, whatever you want to call it, theaters, in the state, I'll go that far, is the Stonington Opera House and the operation that's going on down there. I often go down to Stonington and think to myself, how does a company this size with the great stuff they're doing exist in a town that's really quite small when you put it against a lot of theaters that are operating? So I have invited the person who's going to answer that question today and other questions, hopefully, Meg Tainter, who's the producing artistic director of what is called Opera House Arts, which was the organization formed, what, in the 2000s, something like that?
1999.
To help. Yeah. The theaters had some kind of history. Could you tell us a little bit about it? Burnt down at one point, so on?
It burnt down. It was built in the late 1800s, and it burnt down in the early 1900s. And has been, I mean, I always sort of describe it as like the beating heart of the community for about 100 years. It was a place where they took out the seats and kids played basketball in there. There were roller skating parties.
I've heard that.
Yeah. I think a generation of Islanders got their first kiss watching movies in there. And the more that we do work with the community, the more that I hear people say, I used to walk down the island on a Sunday afternoon to see a matinee and try to hitch a ride back up. And, you know, they're talking about something that was happening in the 30s or the 40s.
Right.
In the 90s, the building sort of fell into disuse. There were a couple different times when it was used more or less, but in the 90s, it really became neglected. And these four wonderful women from New York, on sort of a hope and a prayer, did a tour of the building, fell in love with it, and emerged knowing that they wanted to turn the theater into a theater and to bring it back to life. And I think that one of the things that was amazing about it was they started by doing a listening tour, and they talked to people in the community, and they asked them what they wanted. And so that was how the Opera House came back to life as Opera House Arts in 1999, and it began with some summer seasons, some theater, some jazz, some music, and very quickly also having a full film programming series. And for the next 15 years, the founders were running it in different configurations throughout the years. There were four of them, and then there were three, and then there were two. But they continued to build the organization with a full education programming and a much bigger theater season, and continued to build and improve on the building. And we have the organization that I was lucky enough to step into in 2015.
3 years ago.
Two and a half, three years ago.
What has been some of your largest learnings, so to speak, in over those 3 years about the company, the organization that it is?
Well, I was an arts leader in Boston, and it's...
Now, we want to talk about
We'll get there, but it's a really different world. And my first experience with what the difference was going to be for working in the Opera House was my first summer, the first farmer's market I went to was after a really wonderful evening of storytelling. And people were stopping me left and right in the farmer's market to say how much they love the program, to welcome you to the community. And I just had this moment of, oh, it's, you know, if you're an arts leader in a city, there's a certain anonymity that comes with it. And there's none of that in Stonington.
Well, no. Everybody knows everybody's business. That's for sure.
And it was one of those, you know, I would be in the supermarket and someone would say to me, oh, Meg, I really love the work you're doing on your house. The new dormers look great. And I would think, I don't know who you are, but you know who I am and where I live.
Is that spooky?
It can either be spooky or charming, and I just chose to view it as charming. But so that was a huge learning curve for me right off the bat in terms of what it's like to live in a community that's this tight and this small, and how much people are aware of each other and looking out for each other in a certain sense.
Yes, oh, very definitely.
But also how much people are looking to the Opera House and saying, this is my organization. I don't view myself as the leader who gets to choose everything. I view myself as the curator for the community, is what they want. And so trying to be as active in my listening to them in a way that you wouldn't necessarily do in another situation.
Well, prior to the show, you were talking about you label yourself, call yourself a producing artistic director. And what does that mean? What is the producer part of that lend to the artistic director part of that?
The title came with the job. So I have
okay.
been – it's not that I would label myself that way. It's that I'm trying to interpret what the organization means by that, which I think is really interesting. For me, a producer is someone who is the person who facilitates and allows the work to flourish. And so that means that they are getting the right cohort of people into the room. They are providing them with the resources they need. They are trying to get the right audience into the room. And they're trying to make sure that the organization is constantly learning from what the work that's going on is. The artistic part is, what is the work? How do you figure out what are the parts you want to champion? What are the things that you want to move forward? And so those two things, being the person who's identifying the work that we want to follow as an organization and then making sure that the right people are in the room to make that work and to participate in it, both as audience members or students or creators, that's how I view the combined title.
Subtle.
Subtle. It also includes a fair amount of, you know, the managing director role of doing QuickBooks.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I'm sure that title allows you to be the one to answer every question that comes down the line, artistic or not. It's just good or bad. You certainly know your community that way.
Yeah, and we have a really tight team. I mean, the team at the Opera House blooms in the summer, and we have, you know, 50 artists who'll come in for various ways. But in the winter, there's really 5 or 6 of us who are in the office, and we have it's a really good group, and we work together so that there's not strict boundaries on people's work areas, so that, you know, Pam Ghetto, who's our director of operations, is also working to program the Live for Five so that she can be really responsive to sort of the young families' needs in the community. And I don't think in another organization that would necessarily be a thing that happened, but because of the way we operate, we can sort of give people things that appeal to their strengths and interests.
One of the things you alluded to a few moments ago was the impact of the community over time. People who, as children, skated on the floor in there or whatever. At the same time, the generation that formed the company, that brought it into existence and made it flourish, is passing. In a community that size, how do you reach out to younger audiences, new audiences, to develop an audience base that will stay with you over time?
So that's the question that every nonprofit in the country is dealing with right now.
Amen.
We're doing a number of things. One of my favorite things that we're doing is our community programming in terms of our family days. When I came to the Opera House and saw the sheer scope of work that was available to do and how much our tiny team could take on, I said, I don't really want to be producing a lot of events in isolation. I want to be working in partnership with people wherever possible.
Yeah.
And so what's developed over the past 3 years are these 4 or 3 annual, we just call them family days, but they become collaborations between the Island Community Center, the school, the town of Stonington, the library, the Opera House, the Chamber of Commerce. And what they do is they bring in young families. And these are folks who didn't necessarily have an access point, because we're actually looking for kids who are younger than the kids who might even be able to appreciate our family programming in the summer.
Uh-huh.
And so a good example is next Saturday, the 9th, is our holiday hoopla. And it will start at the Opera House with a vendor fair. And we'll have pictures with Santa Claus and 2 elves who will be getting kids up on the stage so they can take pictures with Santa. There'll be 3 different craft stations in the back that are being manned by the library, the Opera House, and Edible Island. And then after that, there'll be a performance. It's part of our Live for Five programming, which is a $5 ticket for everyone, of a one-man version of A Christmas Carol. And then the next day, the celebration continues on Sunday with a special tree lighting on the pier And then the Candy Cane Social, which has brownies and hot chocolate in the library for all the participants.
Whoa. And that's a day and a half.
It's a day and a half, and it's delightful for us to do. It's wonderful to work with everybody because everyone in that coalition of all those organizations I mentioned takes on a piece of it, so right. It makes it affordable. We can offer it free of charge to everyone on the island to come to. And over the past year and a half, we've been noticing that each time we do one of these, the audience just grows and grows and grows. So last year we had our Stonington Spooktacular for Halloween. We had our holiday hoopla, and then we created something called the Great Down Easter Egg Hunt, which was a town-wide Easter celebration where the kids made Easter baskets and sort of trick-or-treated for Easter goodies and took their pictures and then did an egg hunt at the Opera House. And we just had no idea how big it was going to be. And so the egg hunt was this amazingly fast experience because we had over 100 children show up for it.
My goodness.
So this year we know to make it even bigger.
But now those 100 children, what's going to stay with them? Is it going to be the eggs they found or the theater that exists in their neighborhood?
I think it's going to be the feeling that they are welcome in this building.
I see.
I think for a lot of people, sometimes the Opera House can seem off-putting. We have this...
Why do you say that?
Because it's a little fancy. If there's not a culture of attending live performance in the form of theater,
yeah.
You can go to the Opera House and sit in our beautiful new lobby and wonder if it's for you. Mm. And the answer is yes. Yes, it's for you. And we do a lot of things over the course of the year to make sure that everyone feels welcome. But for these kids, it'll be a part of their growing up that they know that the Opera House has something for them, and right. that for every one of these events, we do try to have some kind of performance component, whether it be a screening of a movie or a live performance, so that in addition to the fun activities and the crafts and the getting to run around in costume, they're also getting an opportunity to experience what live performance can do.
Now, how do you make exceptions to this in some way during the summer when you have a whole new crop of people? They're there for like 3 months and then gone.
The summer is actually the easiest way to engage a lot of people. We have – I keep mentioning our Live for Five programming, and I probably should expand upon what that is. So this is an amazing program that this has been in existence for something like 10 years now, and it's founded by the W.F. Whitman Family Foundation. And what it is it's a weekly hour-long performance. It takes place at 7 o'clock on Wednesdays in the summer. It's live performance of some kind that is geared for all ages. So it can be clown, mime, music performance. We've had movies with live music played in front of them. We've had really good physical comedy and magic tricks. And it's $5 tickets for everyone. And it's the great egalitarian thing because we don't have advanced sales for it. It's you show up at the theater, you get to see a show for $5. And that is an established – people come looking for what's the Live for Five this week? What can I bring my family to? And a lot of times it's also people who don't have kids who are coming to it who want to see the show. So that's a really – and it's a sort of magical and absurd program because it's only possible because of the generosity of the underwriter. It's not something where there's a remote chance of making back what the artist's fees are. But because we have this family that believes in this programming, we've been able to offer this for close to a decade now.
Is this the consequence of being in a small rural area on the outskirts of Maine? Would you do the same thing if you were located in Philadelphia or Portland or Boston?
I hope so. I think so, yeah. The founders are remarkable women. And when they were working at what this organization could be, they were looking at it in terms of how the Opera House serves its community. And that's why our education program is so robust. That's why we offer this low-cost work. It's why we have constant community partnerships in terms of panel discussions. And we're really trying to figure out always how can we be of service to the community. And so that, as the sort of starting point for the organization, shapes how we view programming. Cost can't be a barrier, and having this one stream where it's absolutely not, and it's also a starting point for people to get addicted is great.
Now, given your background, which I'd like to talk about because it's fascinating, back in Boston anyway, that part of it, did you know that this was going to be your role when you came up here?
Oh, no.
When did it dawn on you and how did it come about?
I knew to a certain extent. I mean, I knew that I was taking over the leadership of a theater that was deeply tied into it, its community. And when I was up for the interview, people would mention two performances in particular that they loved. One was The Last Ferryman and one was Burt Dow, Deep Water Man. And both of those were plays that had massive community involvement and were generated by the island. But I don't think I fully understood. I mean, I thought I was coming to run a theater that was also tied into its community. And over the past 2.5 years, I've become very aware that I work at a community center that serves its community through access to the arts and that believes that access to the arts helps people transform.
That's a very different role.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a great surprise to be in this role. And I'm actually more interested in this role than I would be if I was just, oh, I'm running this theater. Uh-huh. I like this idea of how I connect to the community and how the organization can sort of tentacle out and figure out where we can work.
To a certain extent, this mirrors what I'm reading about your experience in Boston, but it's hugely different. As I understand it, you were one of the founders of or leaders of a small company called Whistler in the Dark back in Boston.
Yes.
Which was featured what you call ensemble acting. Could you define that for our audience? What do you mean by ensemble acting?
Sure, yeah. Whistler was an ensemble theater, and that's a term that has any number of definitions. So the one that I give will be my definition and not necessarily what, if you ask another ensemble theater artist, what they would mean. For us, the meaning was that all ideas in a room make the work better, and so that there's an egalitarian approach to the work. So we had an existing company of collaborators who worked together, and that includes stage managers, designers, directors, and actors. We would decide on our season jointly as a group what we wanted to pursue, and then we would work together inside the room to fulfill that vision. So there wasn't the sense that there's just a director and they're going to choose what they want to do for the season and they've got a vision for the play and we're going to enact that. It was really a sense of we're all coming together to collaborate on this and we're going to do work in a way that's over a long period of time. We have this long relationship with each other. I mean, I had one collaborator with me who was there from the beginning and then people sort of joined the company as we went. But by the end, in our final season, people have been working together for 7, 8, 9 years.
Yeah.
You develop a really wonderful
way relationship,
and shorthand and how you want to approach work. And you just it's much deeper than I'm going to rehearse a show for 3.5 weeks and put it up and I might not see those people again.
There, during the, certainly the 60s and the 70s, this ensemble idea really flourished and everyone said, this is the future. Then it became expensive to have 6 or 7 actors always there, sometimes in small roles, sometimes in big roles. And wonderful theaters like People's Theater and Light down in Philly and so on died because of the expense involved in being ensemble. Is that an issue as far as you experienced in Boston?
I don't. Whistler was part of, and I am now an individual member of something called the Network of Ensemble Theaters, which is, if people want to learn more about ensembles, that's a good place to go and look at it.
Yeah.
But it's a loose coalition of people who self-define as ensemble, and it's a way that you can opt into the organization as you sort of decide what that means for your organization. And there's so many different models for how they work. When Whistler was in existence, not one of us pulled our paycheck from it. We had stipends that basically offset the cost of us doing the work, but it wasn't like that was how any of us were paying our rent.
Right.
There are ensembles where people are able to – that's their living. Double-edged Theater in Western Mass is a beautiful example of that. There's a farm that they live and work on together, and they create this amazing immersive work. There are also ensembles that are more close to Whistler's model where they come together and they create work over long periods of time, and maybe they tour it, and while they're touring it, it's their income. But it's not their major source.
Right.
So I think people get really creative with how to make art. We make art because we love it and we need to, and so we find the ways to make that happen.
There is an article that came out. I don't have a date on it. It was when you were down in Boston. But to quote something, I think this is a quote. You're talking about, this is a long sentence, exploring ways that celebrate the imagination through linguistic acrobatics and a stripping away of extraneous tappings. What's that mean?
I like highly poetical texts. I like plays where the playwright is using the words as a way of also challenging my ideas in the theater, so that I'm not super interested in naturalistic language. So the playwrights that I'm drawn to are the Howard Barkers of the world, Carol Churchills, David Greggs, playwrights who are poets as well.
I hear you did writers. Stoppard's, the what was this?
Dog's Hamlet, to Boots Macbeth.
Boy, if you did that and the audience stayed in their seats.
That was a show where we were so sure no one was going to come, and it was sold out every night. People, that's a good play.
Oh, it's a
really
wonderful,
good play.
But the talk about ensemble acting.
Yeah.
Just understanding the what the sounds, which of course is what Stoppard was all about. Or, I mean, why he wrote that play.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
I just was fascinated that you did it.
Yeah. The other half of that quote that you read with the idea of stripping away extraneous trappings, we decided on that pretty early on because we knew we were never going to be a theater company that had a ton of money that we wanted to spend on things.
Yeah.
And so we were really interested in the primacy of the relationship between the actor and the audience and the actor and the other actors. And so we did these incredibly bare-bone productions. We were often teased by our fellow artists in Boston for if we had a rug and two chairs. Ooh, you really broke the bank on the set this time, Meg. And so we really had this very strict aesthetic of only what needs to be in the space. That's what we're going to use for it. And we're going to really focus on the intimacy. It's something you can do when you work in a black box for 50 seats.
That's just what I was going to say. But also it's the kind of thing you do when you're forced to do it, not necessarily because you choose to do it that way.
Although it's, I mean, you can still see it in my work at the Opera House. I just directed Henry IV there, and our set was a full set, but it was a thrust stage with three chairs.
Well, sometimes, you know, a play is so heavy set-wise that you either spend $1,000 and build all this incredible set, or you just say, hey, imagination forms the set.
Yeah, and there's a... As an environmental activist also, there's a part of me that feels very deeply uncomfortable about the let's spend a lot of money to build the set and then put it in a dumpster at the end of the 3-week run.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Meg Tainter, who's the producing artistic director of the Opera House down in Stonington. It's a fascinating organization and certainly one that is much a part of the community, as you're hearing. Meg also, and we just started talking about this, had quite a career down in Boston with a company called Whistler in the Dark, which unfortunately does not still exist, but was a home for actors, which is a little different than many theaters, which is simply a momentary home while they're acting out a show, rehearsing and acting out a show. And then the ensemble, quote unquote, goes their way. It sounds like, Meg, this group in Boston was more the group of people that stay together, learn together, eat together, hate each other, love each other, that kind of thing.
It's family as opposed to,
Right. The theater in Boston, Whistler in the Dark, came to an end. And it's interesting in the article that you talk about what you went through and others went through in making that decision to come to an end. What went through your – what was going on? Yeah, I'm asking the question in the article. Somebody came up to you and said, Big, what's really going on here?
Yeah, it was an interesting moment because so the article you're referring to is from HowlRound, and it's an article I wrote about specifically ensemble. I had curated a week of articles on HowlRound about – how different ensembles worked, and then wanted to, and then had this one capstone piece that was, let me talk about my experience in ensemble. And what had happened was the organization had, I had put out basically a statement saying, hey, we're in the middle of our ninth season. this is going to be it. We have this one last show coming up. We're really excited about that, but we're not going to produce any more shows as an ensemble. And so please come see us. And if you can't come see this final show, we're going to have a wake and we're going to have whiskey and casseroles and like come celebrate the theater with us. And people were very concerned about that. And what had happened was the ensemble had been working together for so long, and we had all reached this point where we were excited about the work but starting to get a little tired. As
the freshness had gone out of it?
Not the freshness. We had gotten ourselves onto a sort of treadmill. And so in the beginning, we would do two, maybe three shows in a year. And by the end, we had 9 ensemble members, 4 of whom identified as directors. And everyone had a project they wanted to do. And so we had so many projects going on that we were jumping from one to the next. And we weren't doing what we loved doing, which was giving ourselves space and giving ourselves the ability to really dive deep into the shows. We were almost on like a regular regional theater rehearsal
model. Yeah, yeah.
So we had a meeting at the end of our 8th season, and we talked about where we wanted to go. And it sort of ended with a moment where people stepped away, and some people said, you know, I want to take just a year off from Whistler, or I want to take a few shows somewhere else, or I really want to keep working at Whistler, so let's do that. And we programmed one last season that was – we didn't know it was our last season yet, but it was just 2 shows. We gave ourselves long, luxurious rehearsal processes. We picked a playwright who we loved, and we just did her work for a year. And by buying ourselves that space, we all sort of had the moment to think and evaluate and see where we were. And we were kind of done as a group. And we all were still going to go off and continue making theater in our way. All of the people who were part of Whistler, most of them, are still acting in Boston or directing in Boston or designing in Boston. But we weren't as interested in having the ensemble work together. And so at that point, I made the call, well, maybe it means that instead of having this ensemble dissolve and me keep the name Whistler in the dark and soldier through and find a whole new group, maybe we just let Whistler have been this thing that existed. And we all see what's next in our lives.
Interesting. That resembles a theater I'm mentioning a couple of times only because I was connected with it down at People's Theater and Light Company. Andre Gregory was the artistic director for a number of years. And this wonderful theater met its demise because Andre decided that he had had enough and left. Now, it speaks something about the company that the artistic director decides to go, and that's the end of the company. How do you work around that? Was that part of what was going on?
No, I mean it wasn't. The decision for Whistler to disband wasn't based on me saying I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. Okay. It was really a collective decision.
All right.
I think that that's always a challenge, and it's one of the things that you see with the transition from the founding leadership of an organization to the next person is always fraught because it's that sense of a founder creates something and they work 90 hours a week on it and they put their blood, sweat, and tears into it. And is the person they hire next going to be able to step in and pick that up and carry it forward? Or
change it completely.
Yeah. Or is there a reason why an organization should keep going forward? I think for an organization like Whistler, where it was one of many theaters in the city, it was a very unique theater, but one of many, there wasn't a need for that theater to keep going and do that work without any of the original founders involved.
Yeah.
But for something like the Opera House, which has just gone through the same transition, that organization is there's a need for it. I'm unbelievably lucky to be there. And it's one of those things where I wake up and think, what a gift that someone designed my dream job and then gave it to me. But the board had to really work very hard in concert with the founders to make sure that there was a way for them to transition beyond that first generation. And I think
let's talk about need here in just a moment. I just need to, if I can use the word twice, I have a need to have a station break here for a moment. We are Maine Arts Alive on WERU Community Radio. We are 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, and of course we're streaming on through our website. And perhaps now is a good moment just for me to add that this is probably the most exciting radio stations, if I can. This is the most exciting place of voices, maybe is a better way of saying it, that exists in this area. Certainly deserves your support, my support, our support. There is really no one else that does just what we're doing. And if you want this to stay around, your support is appreciated. So, again, WERU, and we're talking with Meg Tainter, who is the producing artistic director of the Opera House Arts, is the official name of the organization. And we were just starting to talk about need. What does the community need and fitting into that? Some years ago, back in, I guess this was the 70s, a lot of money was pulled out of federal funding for the arts. And what our intelligent forefathers said was, turn to the theaters and have them go into the schools and perform art so that kids know what art is. Don't give the theaters any money to do this. Just have them do it. And, of course, it came to a swift end because what theater can just do it? On the other side of the coin, what I'm hearing from you is there's a different relationship with your community that is indeed based on a real need, and that need would support you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm thinking of, and I don't have it in my brain perfectly, but there's a wonderful quote that Zelda Fitchhandler gave when she was testifying about the need for theaters to become 501c3s and to be tax charities. And she talks about, oh, my mentors are going to be so disappointed in me that I don't have this on the tip of my tongue. But she talks about once the theater took and claimed for itself that idea of being a charity, they became an institution like a library or a church that wasn't just about the creator's desire to make art, but about the way that that art would help a community grow and flourish. And so I think that there's a number of different ways in which our community needs us that that run a gamut of ways. We have we work a lot in the schools. We have a lot of education work that we do, and we offer it all for free to the schools. So we partner with the Dear Al Stonington Elementary and High School, but also with schools on the peninsula as well. And for none of that are the schools compensating us. That's all underwritten by our generous underwriters and our sponsors that are part of our annual fund. Yeah. And that, I think, is really important. I think it's valuable to have work that is giving kids who might not be necessarily book learners ways to learn through art and ways to learn through performance or recitation or whatever it is that they're doing, that there's different ways of learning, and we can help fill a gap for people. We have a youth education program that we do at the theater that helps and provides a need for the little ones on the island, ages 5 to 9, to be involved in performance. Last year, I was one of the teachers on that, and I am not the best with a herd of 6-year-olds, but it was amazing, and it was fun.
It makes for an interesting learning.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it does.
By the way, for those of you who may not know, Zelda Fitchhandler was, I think she's passed away, yes, the artistic director for the Arena Stage in Washington, which was one of 4 different, maybe close to 7 theaters that came out and established themselves as quote-unquote regional theaters, professional theaters out in the country. And Arena Stage became a leader and is still a leader, in not only in terms of the excellence of their production, but the fact of establishing theater in their communities. Zelda Fitchhandler became kind of an icon in many ways around that.
And that movement really did decentralize. We're not all just looking to New York anymore. There's that sense that wonderful, amazing art can and does happen in your backyard, and you can find those theaters near you. And there's a wealth of them in Maine, which is really amazing to me, that we have so many strong theaters up here that are doing really remarkable work.
Strong arts overall.
Yeah.
I mean, just this Deer Isle, Stonington, that area has more Potters per square inch than any other.
Can't throw a rock without hitting a blacksmith.
Right. Right. And it's it is for the good, I think, overall. Yeah. But it also creates a need for you to be, as producing director, as diverse. Now, you're talking about events outside of, you know, not the theater events, but your theater schedule has got to be extremely diverse. And how do you judge whether or not you are on the right track with that diversity besides seats that are filled, or is that it?
We ask questions. We talk to people. Right now we're in the middle of this really exciting strategic plan. Our strategic plan has expired, and so we're updating it for the next 5 years. And the first stage of that is this deep listening tour that we're doing. So we're meeting people and having one-on-one conversations with them and asking them questions about how they interact with the Opera House, what they interact with us, how they work with us. We have a questionnaire on our website that has over 160 respondents so far. Anyone who wants to take it, operahousearts.org.
Now, is this aimed primarily at your immediate company area or also out
of? It's anyone who interacts with the Opera House. And what we're also trying to find out is if you live in Deer Isle, Stonington, and you don't, why? Why don't you interact with us?
But you've got two very different audiences responding in probably very different ways. One, you're year-round, and the other, your summer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of theaters go dark during the summer. Their season is, you know, fall, winter, into spring. You've got to be two theaters, it seems to me.
Very much. Very much. And what's interesting and challenging about that is making sure that there's a holistic vision for the organization that encompasses who we are in our off-season, in our September to May, and who we are from June, July, and August. I have been so fascinated with reading the responses that we're getting into this questionnaire, because people have, for every person who, when one of the questions is, you know, what do you always want to be true about the Opera House? One person will say, keep doing Shakespeare every year. I love it. And the next response will be, enough with the Shakespeare. I'm done with it. And so having that sort of looking at how that balance can work and, okay, not everything is going to be for everybody. And in fact, not everything we put on is something that I necessarily adore. But finding out how we can serve all the different constituents is really an exciting puzzle.
Oh, amen. I have to laugh when you mentioned Shakespeare. My engineer in the back said, no more. He was in total agreement. Well, if it comes to that, then I can. But are you responsible for doing to do Shakespeare? Is it part of your responsibility to do that kind of drama?
I don't even know how to answer that question. I think Shakespeare is one of the greatest playwrights we have. He told stories that are relevant and human and beautiful and marvelous. And I think a lot of people have seen bad Shakespeare.
I
think that the challenge is to look at his work and find ways to make it so fresh and exciting. This summer, we're doing a production of The Tempest that'll be taking outside at a farm. The audience will be moving with the production as it moves through this glorious landscape. Uh-huh. And I think people who haven't necessarily seen Shakespeare done that way will be completely surprised. And
are these like pageant wagons that you're going to move through?
There'll be three or four stations. Three or four stations that they'll be stopping at as we move along. So there'll be seating in each place that the audience can get to, but they'll be seeing a play, interacting with the landscape in a way that's really wonderful. So I don't think that we're responsible for doing Shakespeare, but I think there's great value to doing it. And it is something of a tradition in Stonington that there's always that open question of, should we keep doing Shakespeare in Stonington? Is that the right thing? Should we do classics? But I think, if we have three shows a summer, we're going to do three different productions each summer. Why can't one of them be Shakespeare? And then one of them can be a modern and one of them is musical. You can do a gamut of shows over the course of a series of months that can appeal to a number of people.
I don't know who said this, and I'm probably misquoting them, but they said to me that regional theaters, smaller theaters that are servicing a community have a responsibility to, if not Shakespeare, offer some kind of theater which really challenges on that level, is so beautifully written, that the words and the sounds are part of it, you have a responsibility. Do you feel that that could be the case?
I don't know that that would necessarily be how I would position it. I think theater is a place where we encounter stories about ourselves that enrich us. And so as long as the stories we're telling are enriching us, then I think that that's a value. And I think that can happen in a number of ways. I do really like – I'm not actually a person who is a specialist in Shakespeare. Directing Henry IV was my first Shakespeare experience as a director. I love watching Shakespeare done well. I love his plays. I think they're beautiful, and I think they are – so surprising in how modern they feel to me in the way that he's thinking about things.
Yeah.
And I think those will always be a part of a conversation that I want to have with my audience. I love the old stories. I also love the new stories. I loved being able to have some of the sort of the American classics on stage this past summer. We're going to have a beautiful play called Mary's Wedding next summer, which is a two-hander written by a Canadian playwright named Stephen Massacott. And it's the contrast between the old and the new and the different ways of telling story, I think, that really help a theater and an audience connect. We're only really talking about the theater right now, which is interesting because we have this whole other – all of the music that we do.
Well, take us there.
Take us there. When I program for the summer, I really am trying to make sure that there's something for everyone. And so that means – and it's – that's not new to me. That is following in the tradition of what the Opera House has done since its inception. So in addition to our three big theater productions, we have a jazz festival that has been going on since the beginning. We do this Live for Five family programming, and then we fill in all these concerts around the place. And I try to get the concert series to be as sprawling as possible so that it can have a full range of things. Last year we had Bog Hat, who are this awesome Irish trad band out of Portland, and we had Derek Semler and his band, and we also had a classical Russian pianist performing a solo concert, and the DePonte String Quartet. So we're looking to create the broadest possible spectrum so that even if classical piano music is not your thing, next week there's a bluegrass band. And so that might be your thing. And so that there's a way to invite everyone in.
Are you making money doing this?
We are. Well, we're a nonprofit theater.
Yeah, but I mean, you still have to have income.
Yeah. But the model for a theater of our size is really you're trying to make 35 to 40% of your money through ticket sales. And the remaining 60 to 65% is through contributed income. So grants, individual sponsorships, business ads.
Was Zelda Fitchhandler who put that one out too.
Yeah. And that's the model that we succeed at. We do hit those ratios, and we do hit our ticket goals, which is really exciting. That when I'm budgeting for a season and I'm saying we need this much money for this concert, we do that.
That's remarkable. I think that's a testament to the value that your organization has in its community, because it doesn't sound like a high percentage, but that's when you figure that it's a $5 ticket here and a freebie there and so on and so forth, you put all that together. What has gone on in the future with your company, you and your company? Where is it going?
That's the big question right now. We're in the beginning stages of the strategic plan. So what will happen for us right now is, as we move through this planning process, we will have we'll be listening to the conversations we're having and culling that information together. And then over the next month, I'll be meeting with members of the board to really look at and analyze that and propose our path for the future. I think more and more, we're going to be working in deep, deep service of our year-round population. Our summer seasons feel right to me. They feel like they're the right size. We get a beautiful cross-section of audience. We can always do better at programming so that we appeal to a broader group of people. But the shape there feels right. It's the work that we do in the winter that I think we can really hone and refine and make sure that we become a gathering space and a place where people just it's a weekend night. I know there's going to be something wonderful happening at the Opera House, and I want to go there.
I hate to draw generalities like this, but it's a fishing community, mm-hmm. and it's a community that perhaps their idea of going out on a Friday night would be to the dance or to the music or so on. Less likely, maybe, to a theater.
We don't do very much theater in the
off-season. I know, but I keep going back there, don't I?
Yeah, you do. We do a lot of music in the off-season, yeah. actually.
So you are pulling that audience in.
Or we've done, last winter, we did a really successful series that we just called the Deer Isle Film Festival, and it was two evenings that were collections of movies that were made on or about Deer Isle. About Life on the Island was one, and Life on the Water.
I bet that went well.
And it was amazing.
Yeah.
We had really wonderful audiences, and when I would go into the theater, I would think, who are all of you? I don't see you in the theater enough. And so how wonderful to get this information of this. This is what you want. You want this moment to talk about your community. Great. Let's
do
that.
So the process of the strategic work, you're going to set goals for the theater as to achieve what you see as an eventual vision 3 or 4 years out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to involve the board in a pretty heavy capacity usually.
It'll involve the board, and it'll also involve community constituents. Yeah. We'll be, once we've done the initial work to draft sort of what the vision is and what those major goals we want to do is, we'll be gathering small cohorts of people to come together and talk about, great, so this is the vision and the goal. How do we achieve that through programming? How do we achieve that through our community work?
What's your relationship to your board? And the board itself is a major factor in all of this. Do you have a board that you feel good about? I'm asking a question on public airways, and you're going to have to say yes. But the only reason that I ask it is that I think one of the things that creates failure or creates success is that relationship between the artistic director and its board. How would you typify that relationship, if I may ask?
On the radio with a microphone?
Yeah, right.
I actually think it's an easy question to answer. I am so unbelievably lucky in my board. I have smart, passionate volunteers who one of our board members says that what we look for is wit, worth, wisdom, wealth, and witness. And they do that. They roll up their sleeves and they get down to it. We just had a mailing of our annual appeal, and we had our board chair in there sticking stamps on 3,500 letters that had to go out. Our committees are active, and they're very passionate. I think we have a really wonderful group of people together who love the Opera House and have come to this board because the Opera House has enriched their lives immeasurably. And so they have a very strong vested interest in having it continue. I think of them as being a very engaged board in that sense.
If your board turned around and said, Meg, how would you paint the picture of the future of this theater 3 or 4 years out? What would come to your mind? What would you say to them off the top of your head?
I think I would want us to have fully embraced this idea of being a community center first that uses art as a way of connecting people through and across different communities. And I think there's a lot of different tiers to that. I think that we have so many community groups. We have the people who live on the island. We have the people who live on the peninsula. We have the people from away who summer. And we also have, and this is not a constituency group that we often think about when we're doing season planning, but we have the artists who come to work with us every summer, the technicians, the theater artists, the musicians. And I think we need to be a community center for them as much as we are for other people.
That's a very interesting statement.
So that the Opera House can continue to be a place where people come to generate work. And it's not just a place where you're going to tour your show to, or 5 weeks you go up in the summer to put on a show on an island in Maine, but it's a place that people think of as their artistic home. And so the work can really flourish in wonderful and creative ways that way. We already are on that path. We just need to deepen it.
You're on that path in what? How so?
Oh, we have artists who've been working with us since the beginning, and who really do view us as an artistic home. For example, Melody Bates, who is a really wonderful actor and has been in innumerable shows at the Opera House. A few years ago, she wrote a play called R&J and Z, Romeo and Juliet and Zombies, that premiered at the Opera House in rep with Romeo and Juliet and got really wonderful response, and then went on to have a performance in New York.
Really?
Well, Melody is coming back up this year, and over the next year and a half, she's going to be working on a piece called Avalon, which is a site-specific piece that'll be taking place at Nervous Nellie's Jams and Jellies, Peter Beard's amazing outdoor sculpture that's about the Arthurian legends. And for Melody, I think she would be okay with me saying this, the Opera House is an artistic home. It's a place where she can come and create and make work, and that she's been working here so long that she knows the community she's working with and she's tapped in.
Well, that, of course, springs to mind many summer locations where artists do come together, and it's they don't have any responsibility other than pursuing their art together and individually. Is that kind of where you see the Opera House going?
I think it's one tier. I mean, I don't want to focus on the artistic community at the exclusion of the audience and the community. But I think that it's important that we start thinking about them, too, as we think about the future of the organization, because the artists are – they create the work that we see. And so if they are coming up – and we also have a residency program where artists can come up for a week or two and just use our resources and work during the off season. If people are building work here, I want that work to also be part of our community's experience. I want people to see what this community makes possible.
Okay, so – We see a possible future for the Opera House. How about it? Where do you fit in the future? What's your goals?
What are my goals?
Yeah.
My hopes and dreams?
And we'll keep it to the theater and the Opera House.
I'd like to be at least the person who helps shepherd us to the next stage. I don't know that I'm a person who's going to be in Maine for the rest of my life. I love it here. I have a great dog and a great house, and I love my work at the Opera House. But I want to make sure that there's a constant conversation with, am I always going to be the freshest eyes for this? Am I going to be the person who is able to see the organization anew every day and not get stuck in, this is how we do things here?
Won't that depend upon the people you bring around you?
It will very much. And but I also want to be very aware always of, I love this organization. I think it's immeasurably invaluable to the community, and I want to make sure that it is served by its leadership. So right now, I think that's me. I love it here, and I'm proud of the work we're doing. But I don't know what that is long term. Right now, I'm really just enjoying the experience of planning for the next 5 years.
One of the things that you note somewhere is that you have the best dog in the world. Tell us about your best dog.
Oh, well, we are on the radio, so you can't see him. Peregrine, he's the greatest. He's a combination German Shepherd, Catahoula, reindeer, 80 pounds of love. He's just wonderful. He's an Opera House dog, so anyone who comes to the Opera House, he's there in the office waiting to greet you.
To wait.
And he's a good rehearsal dog, too. He'll hang out in the rehearsal hall with me as well.
So what's coming up next that the audience might want to buy a ticket for? Or what's happening?
Well, I think everyone should come next Saturday at 2 o'clock for the One Man Christmas Carol. It's part of our Live for Five programming, as I said. And the actor who's doing it, Neil McGarry, is a wonderful actor who I know back from my Boston days. And he just got – when he performed this show originally on the Cape, he won all sorts of awards for it. It's a piece that he's been working on, and it's really lovely.
Yeah.
We have some good movies coming up. Thor is next weekend, which is great. We've got the new Jane Goodall documentary starting tomorrow night, which is wonderful. And then in January, in the third week of January, we are doing a play in a day. So
say that again.
We're going to put on a stage reading in a day.
Oh.
So on Monday the 21st, we'll be having just a potluck dinner. Folks can come and we'll read the play out loud. And then John Lincoln and myself – John is the director of The Reach at the Deer Isle Elementary School. We'll be directing it. So we'll cast the show, and then folks will show up that Saturday at noon. We'll have 5.5 hours of rehearsal, and then that night we'll go on stage. And we're really hoping for a huge cross-section of the island to be performing in it.
There's some ambitious stuff coming up.
That'll be delightful.
Yeah.
We don't rest in the winter. We keep going pretty strong.
I'll say. But clearly, you know, there are two audiences, and you as producing artistic director have to be keenly aware of that. But the fact that you have brought this all together is, I think, remarkable.
Oh.
We have just a few moments left out of the hour, which you said will take forever, and you see the hour is almost up. So, you know, is anything that you would like to add, a telephone number, anything like that to get in touch with you, your box office and so on, websites?
Yeah, well, so Opera House Arts maintains everything that we do on our website, which is operahousearts.org. We're also pretty active on Facebook, so if people want to follow us on Facebook, they'll get all the information there. And you can always call us at 367-2788.
Would you repeat that?
367-2788.
Okay.
And if folks are interested in talking to us about the strategic plan and filling out the survey, if you just go to our website, there's a link and you can take a 5-minute survey that will really help us choose the shape of the Opera House's future.
How much longer will you be at the stage of filling out a form?
The survey is going through the 15th of December, so another 2 weeks.
Okay. Anything that you would like to add in closing that we've talked about that you want to make sure the audience walks away remembering?
I'm so grateful for this opportunity to talk about the Opera House. I think that the thing I would be most excited for people to walk away is knowing that we're listening and we're trying to make sure that you're served. So if you are a person who's in our community and you want to be involved, the answer is yes, you're invited. Tell us how we can make that possible for you.
This is Meg Tainter, who's the producing artistic director of Opera House Arts down in Stonington, a place that I think just about anybody who lives in this area, certainly of Maine, if not the state as a whole, has been at some point and seen the big, massive Stonington Opera House sign on the loft building, knows it, and hopefully has gone to a show or will go to a show. So I thank you, Meg, very much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I look forward to coming down and seeing a show. That's it, folks, for Maine Arts Alive. Don't forget we're in the fundraising mode, which means you help us out. Take care, all. Bye now.
Got about a minute and a half before the hour. On the Wing with Mark Dyer coming up at 11 o'clock. Let's take a quick look at the weather while we're waiting. Mostly sunny with a high near 41 this today. Light southeast winds becoming south 5 to 10 miles an hour this afternoon. Tonight, rain mainly after 11 p.m., low around 36. South winds 7 to 10. Chance of precipitation is 90%. New precipitation amounts between a tenth and a quarter of an inch possible. We're going to be a little bit wet tonight. Friday, a chance of rain before 7 a.m., then a chance of showers between 7 and 9. Cloudy through the morning, then gradual clearing with a high near 46.
I made a mistake. Sorry, that's all the operator.
That's okay.
Error. 3, 2, 1, go.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Carding Brook Farm, MOFCA-certified organic vegetables, as well as timber frame houses and barns built with wood from their farm in Brooklyn. 359-2326.
Hello, this is CJ Walk, your host for Calming Ground Radio, which airs on the first Friday of each month at 10 a.m. here on W.